from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to bicker about. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call us direct at 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may be also able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website of the show can be found on the BBS Radio site.
I'm sorry to break in. I have to break in here. There's one line that must be really bad, because it's giving quite a static. Do you mind? I mean, I don't mind.
No, I don't mind.
Okay, then I'll keep you on the air. But there is one line that's either yours or your guest that's quite bad, and that's causing quite a... That's okay. We'll keep it going. Just letting you know.
Okay.
Okay, sorry.
And those are the things that happen in real life. Well, you can find the website for this show at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. And all of those past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible, or even extra humanly possible, on the station archives. Now, my own blog is titled, How the Neocons Stole Freedom, and it is conveniently located at http://howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. This week, you can read about W. Leon Smith, the editor of The Iconoclast. That's the hometown paper for Crawford, Texas, that after careful consideration endorsed John Kerry in 2004. This did not make the neocons happy, and an unhappy neocon is a nasty creature indeed. Smith was threatened physically, and attempts were made to drive him out of business. But he did not back down. In fact, he started doing more. His courageous stand on the truth and an independent media made the Iconoclast a paper that brought in whistleblowers from deep inside the Bush administration. If you go on the site, lonestaricon.com, you'll see the kind of stories he published. They give the reader the kind of information Americans desperately need to find direction. Stay tuned for more, because the Iconoclast has plans to make more happen. And now our updates from the week just passed. The battle of the petitions over the Bush Library at SMU. To date, 10,658 people are protesting the Bush Library at SMU and have signed that petition. 133 support the Bush Library at SMU, just so you know. And while the world focuses on the trials of Anna Nicole Smith and the fortune she should have had, the media ignores the fact that the Libby trial has gone to the jury and that Congress is now considering legislation to end the war in Iraq by changing the 2002 mandate given to Bush. I guess the traditional media have their marching orders. Ironically enough, if you understand what's really on issue with the Smith trial, you see how all three issues actually flesh out a story that makes many things crystal clear to all viewers. It's not just about money. The Anna Nicole Smith litigation was over control of a huge slug of stock in a very private corporation that has links all over the neocon world. That's Koch Industries. If you look over the list of board members and contributors, you'll find them to be prominently represented at various places that we associate with neocons. Charles Koch was one of the founders of Cato Institute. Those now in control don't talk. but a stockholder could rip the shroud of secrecy off, causing many things to happen. This and many more connections will be charted coming up soon, so stay tuned. And now our thought for the week ahead. While winter lingers and the world awaits the spring equinox, which will mark the global moment when we balance between birth and death, summer and winter, many things hang by a thread. Two issues divide the right and the left. If you care to examine the underlying premises, those issues are rights for women and the environment. All else flows from those two. These two issues are the source of much dissent and anger. Individuals on the right and left simply often react instead of examining their ideas and checking the facts. Ayn Rand cautioned us to always check our premises. She might not have done it herself, but it's still a good idea. Last week, you heard from Doug Lorenz, chairman of the Republican Liberty Caucus for California, former national chairman for that group. We talked about the need for a new approach to public discourse, and soon a group will be formed that will be coming out with a plan to make that happen. An American dialogue will take up issues that divide us. The first issue will be the Pledge of Allegiance. Why do we do it, and what purpose was it written to accomplish? The answers will probably surprise everyone. Know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Our guest today is working on the accountability aspects of the problems we now face. Elizabeth de la Vega, a former federal prosecutor, was an assistant U.S. attorney in Minneapolis, as well as a member of the Organized Crime Strike Force and branch chief in San Jose, California. She retired from that position in 2004 and wrote a book that lays out the case for an indictment, a blueprint for the real thing, so to speak. Please welcome Betsy de la Vega. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, I'm so glad that you could be with us today to share this exciting insight that you have created with your book.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, my book is written under the name of Elizabeth de la Vega, which is, of course, my formal name. But people do sometimes call me Betsy. But if people were to look for the book, they wouldn't find anybody named Betsy.
Okay, so they should definitely look for Elizabeth.
Yes.
Well, we always start by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves. So why don't you tell us about Elizabeth de la Vega?
Okay, well, I did work for over 20 years as a federal prosecutor. I was in Minneapolis for 11 years and 10 years in San Jose. And during that time, I worked on virtually every kind of federal criminal case that is possible, ranging from bank robberies to complicated white-collar crime. And when I was in San Jose, I was a member of the Organized Crime Strike Force, and I was also the chief of the San Jose branch of the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Mm-hmm.
I retired in the fall of 2004, and I took some time to kind of regroup, and then I started writing articles regarding political and legal issues for a website called Tom Dispatch, which
mm-hmm.
is online.
And that's actually an affiliate of The Nation, right?
Yes, it is. And I actually have had articles published in The Nation and the LA Times, Christian Science Monitor, and various other print and online publications. And then most recently, I've written this book, U.S. versus George W. Bush et al.
And that's certainly enough to lighten any of our hearts. The idea that that could happen is very exciting.
Right. Well, unfortunately, as I explained in the introduction to the book, the purpose is not to make people think that this could really happen, but rather it actually fits in precisely with what you've just been talking about, which has to do with the nature of our public discourse. And I wrote it because I was really appalled at our public discourse. And when I was working, of course, you asked me to tell me about listeners about myself. I have five children. They're a little bit grown now, but I was a pretty busy person with doing trials and taking care of my family and so forth. So I really wasn't attuned to the mainstream news, especially TV.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did take early retirement, I had a chance to pay attention. And I was really just appalled by what seemed to me, I referred to it in the book, as a drive-by shouting and people just hurling slogans at each other and attacking each other personally. And it was clear to me why it was that people seemed to have very little understanding whatsoever of how the administration really deceived the public about the war. So my purpose in laying out the case, and the reader is invited in as a grand juror just to read the evidence. And my purpose in doing that was just to let people look at the evidence in a less highly charged form than what seemed to be prevalent on TV and in the news in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very valuable thing to do, and you're certainly right, especially about the neocons, because you can see the same pattern recurring over and over and over again in terms of the way they abuse the whole process of civil discourse.
They absolutely do, and in fact, the book is laid out in terms of days, or 6 days of grand jury testimony, and the first day is pretty much devoted to information background about the neoconservatives. And I'm sure your listeners know a lot about them since this is something you focused on a lot. But one of the most distressing things about the neoconservatives, especially in the run-up to the war, is that they never honestly set out what their true ideas are. And in fact, which are, of course, this global preeminence and having a substantial force presence in the Middle East and the entitlement to oil and so forth.
Everybody has their fantasy.
Right. Except for them, it seems, they've blurred fantasy and reality. But they never really talked about those ideas. And the reason they didn't, in the larger communities, of course, they talk about them in their own neoconservative circles. But the reason they didn't talk about them publicly, and certainly why they didn't advance them as arguments for the war, is because when they first talked about them, they were really laughed out of the room, so to speak, in the early 1990s. They knew the public thought those ideas were radical.
I don't know if they thought they were radical as much as they thought they were inane.
Well,
you're really talking about Straussianism there.
Right. Well, I think the public, certainly when in 1992, when Libby and Wolfowitz wrote the documents that they wrote for Cheney, the response in the press was that they were, whatever word you want to use, crazy was one of them. And so clearly this group of people knew that the public wouldn't accept the ideas, however you want to describe them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly true, because if you tell people that, one, you have a right to lie to get your way because
mm-hmm.
you're special,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of people. I mean, none of my kids would have believed that would have worked when they were 3 years old.
No.
So it does make you wonder how these people were raised.
It actually does make you wonder about that. In fact, I heard Ralph Nader make that comment the other day. But, yes, and the idea that people could be so entitled in so many other ways as well, that we would, as a country, be entitled to rule the world, or that we would be entitled to oil in these countries so far away and so forth. It's a very strange approach to the world. And what was even worse about it is that in the run-up to the war, when there were people who knew that, say, for example, Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld espoused these ideas, and they would publicly say so, the people would say that, they were the ones who were criticized as being wrong or off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So no one ever, none of the administration officials admitted what the true underlying beliefs were that led us to this war.
Well, if you're laughed off the stage, you're certainly not going to continue to talk about it if you're at all clever. Nobody ever said these people weren't clever.
No, they're definitely clever. I'd say Machiavellian would be accurate as well. It wouldn't be hyperbole to say that.
No, it wouldn't. They definitely are. And
mm-hmm.
they've used some interesting techniques. Earlier we talked about the fact that these people use ad hominem attacks,
mm-hmm.
you know, just as a matter of course. They insert disinformation. What's your reaction to Ann Coulter? as she is very much a prominent mm-hmm. neocon figure. And CPAC's coming up, so of course she'll be making her appearance there again.
Okay, I don't know what CPAC is.
That's a conservative.
To be honest with you, I try to avoid listening to or hearing about Ann Coulter to the largest extent possible, but I believe that she is completely dishonest. She's intelligent, obviously, but completely dishonest about her arguments and the supposed facts that she uses to buttress her arguments. And she's a person I just simply can't even fathom. I don't understand how she operates in the world. And I also don't understand why she has a forum. Why do we even listen to somebody like that? She's not only dishonest, she's hateful.
Well, certainly what she said about, the widows of 9/11 was completely shocking and appalling. But she got enormous ink off of it.
Right, right. And I think that is, that's why a show such as yours is such a breath of fresh air, because I really don't know how we've come to a place in this society where what's most important is that people get publicity for being as nasty and unkind as they can possibly be, of course, including Bill O'Reilly, who made these statements about the young man who was kidnapped and held captive for 4 years,
mm-hmm.
saying that he liked it better there than if he had been at home. If I ruled the world, which I clearly don't, none of those people would have any airtime whatsoever.
Yes. But it sort of makes you wonder about a world where, one, they continue to sell
right.
as well as they do. Of course, there's a question about that, you know, because if you take a look at how much they actually sell and how many of those books are actually purchased through, Heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the neocon think tanks, of course, that even calls that into question.
Right. I know that if you look at Amazon rankings, for example, on books like that, they're largely dictated by these large purchases,
mm-hmm.
Which is another dishonest thing. I have no problem with people who want to come out and argue their points of view. And if somebody... like William Crystal, actually, I have to say, another neocon, he actually does pretty much say his point of view. But if people want to advance a cause and have so little integrity that they aren't even willing to say what their arguments are, then I have no regard for them at all. And that's, of course, what the administration did in the run-up to the war. They
mm-hmm.
didn't tell the public what the real reasons were. And then, because they knew the public wouldn't agree with the real reasons...
Well, that would be kind of awkward if they actually said what their reasons were.
Right,
well... You can see why they couldn't do that.
Right, but awkward. We're talking about invading a country that's 8,000 miles away, so, awkward. I don't even know if awkward fits into the mix, really.
Well, you have to use some word. What do you say when you say, I want to go steal his oil?
Right, right. And one of the things I do talk about in the book is that we have come to expect so little from our elected officials, but that's really not how the Constitution was designed, and it's not how the laws of our country are designed. In fact, when someone becomes an elected official and they take the oath of office, they're sworn to uphold the Constitution and defend the laws of the United States. They're subject to the laws of the United States. So,
and there is supposed to be accountability there.
Yes, there's accountability and there are legal obligations that they have. So it is, in fact, illegal once for the president to set about to defraud the entire country and Congress in order to get the war that he wants.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and it is illegal, which, of course, brings us to the issue of it's just such a wonderful idea indicting him. It just would seem like we should be able to do that.
Right. Well, what I hope to do in the book by laying out this conspiracy to defraud the United States, by the way, is based on a statute. It's not something I made up, and it's in the criminal code, and it prohibits using fraud in any organized way to interfere with Congress or a branch of government. And what I wanted people to understand is that this administration used the same techniques of fraud that the people used in, say, Enron, or people used in any kind of fraud, land sales or selling a bogus cure for something. They used the very same techniques, but they did it on a massive scale that's unheard of, at least in my experience as a criminal prosecutor,
mm-hmm.
and with results that are just absolutely horrific. So given that we know that, really what we need here, of course, is Congress to do its job. And in this case, they are the investigators. They are, as Barbara Jordan said in the Nixon era, the inquisitors. And that's their job, is oversight, and they're supposed to be doing it.
Aha. And, of course, we've all noticed that they aren't doing it, though they've done a few little things, which is a little bit encouraging.
Right.
At least you don't have to give up all hope yet.
No, no. I've been doing a lot of these interviews, of course, and I really hope that people don't give up, because what I hope is that people will make their voices heard, and the framers of our Constitution really designed the government with a fourth branch, which is the people of the United States. And so we really, each of us has an obligation as well. But Congress is doing some things, and a lot of what they do is not publicized, but one person who hammers away at things a lot is Henry Waxman, and the representative from Southern California. And I have a lot of faith in him, and I think he is diligent, and he's moving forward with the issues relating to the contracting fraud in
mm-hmm.
Iraq, among other things.
Well, but they are, of course, dealing with neocons here. And
mm-hmm.
the interesting thing about neocons, if you take a look at the strategies engaged in by Rove and company over
mm-hmm.
the last many, many years, it's very clear that they always have a secondary plan.
Mm-hmm.
And have you given any thought to what their secondary plan might be in this case?
Which case?
Well, in the case you're taking a look at the idea that there might be an impeachment, because there's certainly
right.
Mexico voted out their resolution.
Right. Well, I think at this point that some of their secondary plans are running into each other, and they are starting to have a hard time not stepping on each other's toes. And I think one example of that is actually the Libby case
mm-hmm.
and the trial, and I don't know how much your listeners know about that. But
please tell us some about it.
Okay, well, the evidence that has come out in that trial, which is, of course, is a perjury trial relating to false statements made by Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's top aide, in the grand jury and to FBI agents. And the jury is out right now, but much of the evidence that came out in that trial shows very clearly and dramatically that Vice President Cheney was pulling the strings behind the scenes, not in terms of causing Libby to commit perjury, but rather with the outing of Valerie Plame, Joseph Wilson's wife. So I believe that they had this idea that, well, maybe Libby could be the, they could proceed just having Libby with this perjury trial, but what's inevitable in any trial is that things come out that you don't really want to have come out. And now they're in a position where who knows what the next step is. I think that it's highly possible that Congress could start investigating this situation, because what you have here, in terms of the outing of Valerie Plame, regardless of whether it's a statutory crime, it's clearly an abuse of power, the kind of abuse of power that is an impeachable offense, because
mm-hmm.
it's an abuse of power to use the offices of government and one's role in government to advance a personal cause, which would be to go after somebody who was your critic. And that's clearly what happened here. So, and they're having so many investigations coming at them from all sides, and I know they actually hired this lawyer, I think his name is Fred Fielding, who was, his expertise actually has to do with congressional investigation. So that's an indication that they are very worried.
Well, you certainly can see why they would be, because there's huge things to lose here. And there have been indications that all is not well in liber and neocon land on a lot of different levels. I don't know if you caught the article in Fox News recently about Murray Strong.
No. Tell me about that.
Well, Murray Strong, of course, is one of the people who's associated with Food for Oil. And
oh, okay.
He's been associated with the United Nations since at least the late 60s. And he's been identified, you know, rather frequently as one of the people who actually was hired by the petroleum companies to take the UN off course.
Mm.
And then to take the environmental movement off course.
Mm-hmm.
And so for him to be outed in Fox News is very interesting, because if he were outed, say, in The Nation, then you'd put in a different interpretation
mm-hmm.
on it.
Right. Well, there do seem to be some indications. I don't watch Fox News, but I have read a couple of things. One, Chris Wallace calling out one of the administration officials on something. And I would imagine that there are many people who are conservatives but not neoconservatives who were fooled as well by the neoconservatives and really are beginning to be appalled at when they're finding out what exactly the agenda really is here, because it's insane.
Well, it is, very much so.
And now we have, of course, Iran looming. And as I looked back at my book the other day, it's just so chilling, the similarity between the run-up of statements about Iraq and the denials that we were planning to actually invade when we'd actually already attacked Iraq. And, for example, in September 2002, when Helen Thomas asked Ari Fleischer about the president's mission to invade Iraq, Ari Fleischer said, "Mission? What mission?" And that was, of course, when we had already been attacking Iraq. And now we have Tony Snow saying it's an urban legend that the administration is thinking about invading Iran. Interesting.
But we all know that it's true.
Right. Well, that's the strange thing about these times that we live in. We know so many things, but people seem to be paralyzed as far as what to do about it.
Well, and I think that may be actually ending, because
mm-hmm.
one of the things that you see going on now is that people have gotten to the point where they realize that what these people are doing is using rhetoric as a way of simply lying.
Right.
Because they'll say anything. I mean, it reminds you of a date with a high school kid.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say anything they have to say to
right.
get what they want.
Right. And part of the reason I wrote the book, too, was to explain that under the law of fraud, it's not just an outright lie. People often debated, well, the president couldn't have lied because he didn't know anything. People actually would say that. You know, he never
Well, read. Actually, I believe that.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you can still commit fraud regardless of whether you know anything, because when you're intentionally trying to deceive, make people think that you are certain about something, but yet you haven't really looked into it behind the scenes, that's one form of fraud. Or if you artfully word something in a way to make people think, say, there's a connection between Iraq and 9/11, that's another form of fraud, even though what you say is literally true.
Well, yes, and there has been a tremendous amount of that sort of thing and misdirection and manipulation on just about every level you can imagine with these
right.
people. And what do you think? I mean, people are now, I think there's over 50% of the population in America are now really seriously talking about impeachment, which is really rather astonishing.
It really is. And I think back to the time of Nixon, because the people in the public were not talking about impeachment. But here we have, in fact, just this week, I was in Seattle, or Olympia, Washington, rather, and there were 850 people there at an impeachment forum, and one of the representatives, or the senator, state senator, introduced into the Washington legislature a resolution of impeachment, and that has growing support in Washington, and that's not the only state where that's happening. And the way that would work is that if it is passed, it has to be introduced into the House of Representatives in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be acted upon, of course, but it is a way for people to get their voices heard. And it is unprecedented to have all these groups and all these people saying, we want to have this president impeached. And Congress, of course, is saying, we don't want to talk about it. But.
Well, that's very interesting, because I know a lot of people, including David Swanson, who you know very well.
Right.
That's what they expected. They wanted to put these people in office, and then they expected them to go do the job.
Mm-hmm.
So people in Congress are now dealing with the fact that the people who put them into office aren't very happy with them.
Well, absolutely, and with good reason, because really, there's really no question that there are grounds for impeachment at this point. Whether you look at the fraud relating to the war or the president's admitted violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, he's admitted that he conducted spying without going through the processes that are required in that act. So that's both a felony and an abuse of power. And the key, of course, is that impeachable offenses aren't necessarily the same as statutory crimes. But if you have one that is an abuse of power, that's an impeachable offense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. And then we have the promotion and sanctioning of torture, kidnapping and sending people to places where we know they're going to be tortured. And then we have these signing statements, which are to me the last straw, because there the president is essentially signing a law with his fingers crossed behind his back,
mm-hmm.
you know, and saying, well, okay, I'm signing this, but I'm really not going to follow it. And if that's not an impeachable offense, I really don't know what one is.
There's so many impeachable offenses. They're so thick upon the ground, it just seems like there should be an impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
So an indictment would be nice.
An indictment would be nice. The problem with the indictment, and the reason it is hypothetical, and with the idea that it might spur people in Congress to take some action, is that a federal indictment, of course, would have to be approved by, guess who? Alberto Gonzalez.
Yes, and he's probably not going to do that.
You think? I would say that's true. Exactly. So that is a problem.
Yes. And is there any way that the people could get around that?
I don't know of a way. I do feel that one thing I've been telling people in these different groups I speak to is it's important when you talk to others not to assume, first of all, that they know as much as you do, because there are many people who are completely immersed in the news and so forth, and I think they mistakenly assume that everybody feels the same way or understands the same information. So what I think is useful is to just pick a few things and become familiar enough with them that you can talk to them, talk to other people about them and say what you think as opposed to what they should think. And it seems to be a pretty successful mode of communication.
You know what would be interesting? It would be very interesting, because you've written the book, to conduct the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Because that would be very educational for the American people.
It would. Well, what we're hoping to have happen, actually, and I think it's going to happen, is that there's a fellow who's expressed an interest in making it into sort of a quasi-documentary film where we would do at least some of this in a movie. And it would be conducting the trial in the form of a movie. And I think that would probably get wider circulation, because there are a lot of people who don't read books.
That's true, but, you know, it could also happen online.
Right, right.
It would be interesting to see this happen as a video game.
Oh, well.
Indict the president.
Mm-hmm.
And you could run it all of these different ways. And that way, of course, you could get kids to do it, too.
Right. Or at least college kids, maybe, yeah. One of the strangest phenomena right now to me is why the college students aren't particularly interested in any of the stuff that's going on. And I fear that it's because there is no draft.
Well, I think you're probably right. Yeah. I mean, the thing that galvanized them in the 60s and 70s was the fact they were being drafted and they didn't like it.
Right. Because actually, when you compare what's going on now in terms of the executive branch versus what the executive branch was doing then, this is truly much, much worse. It's absolutely comprehensive. And as you know, based on your study of the neocons, one part of it is, especially in the case of Cheney, to get more power for the executive branch. And he was particularly upset about the fact that the executive branch's power was diminished after Nixon, after the Watergate era. So they really have been carrying out all these various prongs of their plan. And they're quite successful, which is why when people say these people are stupid or don't know what they're doing, I would say it's not the case. I think they're doing exactly what they want to do.
It's obviously a very long-term plan. They have been working on this for an incredible period of time.
Mm-hmm.
The group that actually put together the evangelical Christian movement is, you know, a voting bloc within the Republican Party, started in the early 70s to
mm-hmm.
do that. So you're really talking an amazingly long-term plan here with a really deep insight into how American politics works. The whole thing is sort of is rather mind-boggling. It goes so far into fantasy land, though, in terms of what they were planning. You wonder what they could have been thinking, because it's like they didn't think that people would ever get wise to them.
Right, they didn't think that. That is actually a very common thing that I observe prosecuting criminals over the years, is that there is this element of people are acting intentionally in deceiving, but there also is always an element of delusion that they think that they're never going to get caught. But enough time goes by and enough things start running into each other, including reality, which you really can't avoid in the end, that they end up getting caught. And
mm-hmm.
and people, it's taken the public a very long time to catch on to the Bush administration, I'm sorry to say, but I think people, for example, are not really believing what the administration is saying about Iran. That's the sense I get, that there's a lot more skepticism generally than there was.
Well, it's interesting because there's skepticism, but I think that part of that's actually, they couldn't mean that. They couldn't do that because that's just too bizarre.
You're absolutely right, and I tell people that all the time. You can't apply your own standards of rationality to the way that conservatives think, because they don't have that same standard. And so really nothing is too crazy.
So actually what you're saying is that it would be useful to take a look at where they want to go, and we know a lot about that now.
Mm-hmm.
So what they want is to create a corporate state where they have perpetual control
mm-hmm.
of all aspects of our lives. And everything is organized so they pump money out in every imaginable way, and they have no accountability for anything that they do. And anything that promotes that worldview is something they would be likely to be engaging in.
Oh, absolutely. And one fallout from that was what happened with Hurricane Katrina, because it was definitely part of the administration's plan and the neoconservatives' plan to minimize the federal government in terms of its role in emergency management and that kind of thing. And they gutted FEMA, and look what happened. It's not a coincidence that that happened. And it wasn't really incompetence on their part. It was actually intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't fit with what people think the role of government is or what would be competent to most people, but it's very competent in their minds because that's exactly what they wanted to achieve.
So really, in a sense, they have been telling us exactly what they're all about and what their intentions are. But what we need to do is sort of turn down the volume so we aren't confused by what they say.
Right. Sometimes they've been telling us, but sometimes a lot of what they've been doing actually has been to regulation, sometimes regulation, sometimes deregulation. But President Bush has quietly been going around, particularly with the environment, changing regulations left and right so that emission standards are changed, and I'm talking about corporate factory type emission standards and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And these are things that people don't even notice. Who would know? I mean, they have a comment period, but how many people read the Code of Federal Regulations every day?
Well, they don't. But actually, if you take a look at what takes place in Congress, there are certain things that have been sort of indicative. Now, this doesn't necessarily involve the neocons, though it did take place while the Republicans were in control of Congress. They went in and zeroed out the potential liability for people, for corporations who were decided they wanted to bring liquid natural gas on shore.
Oh, right.
And that would certainly be indicative. If somebody says, if it blows up, I don't want to be responsible, I think that that's something that, you know, you could pay attention to.
Oh, right. There are clearly a lot of things you can pay attention to, but a lot of things that they do that nobody knows about. Another regulation was the president signed an executive order changing the way various civil service offices operate, saying that each one had to have a political appointee in there. And that's completely alien to anything that we've had for years and years and years in the federal government.
Now, didn't they completely defund the civil, you know, the Civil Rights Agency?
Yes.
I seem to remember that happened too.
Yes, they did. And in fact, most of the people they've hired in the Department of Justice Civil Rights section are people who don't believe in the principles of civil rights. There are people who are against civil rights. And that's another thing they've done, is they put people in who are, you know, like the fox guarding the hen house. All the different appointees in various agencies are people, certainly environmental people in the environmental agencies, are people who are anti-environment
mm-hmm.
regulation.
So it's sort of like you see the fox sitting there and he's got some feathers on his little maw there.
Right, right, right. And
that's who they've had taking care of things.
Right, and all along, when people try to point this out in the public arena, especially in the mainstream news, those who are trying to point it out are seen as being paranoid or hypercritical or partisan. But in fact, what the critics are saying is absolutely true, and this should be the substance of the discussion. And or worse, they're attacked, as we've seen in so many different situations, with partisan attacks.
Huh. Well, there's so many things that they've done. It would be interesting, you know, to put up a wiki
mm-hmm.
so that people could see. If you saw the monumental aspect of, I think, what's going on here, I think it would have even more of an impact on the American public. Because it's hard to take it all in, I think.
It is. That's part of the problem. Oftentimes, when criminals just keep going from one crime to another, well, sometimes it makes it easier to catch them, but a lot of times it makes it harder because they just keep moving.
Well, tell us about that. You certainly have a lot of experience in that area.
Right. Well, what happens is, I mean, here, you can see it even when you listen to a hearing, say, of the Judiciary Committee or whatever, and Alberto Gonzalez is in there, you have all these different people, congresspeople, trying to ask questions, and they're jumping around from one topic to the next. And it's the same thing with criminals. If they commit one crime and you try to start solving that one, but then they move on to another one, they get everybody's focus changed, and then people go on to that one, and nothing ever gets solved, which is why I think it's really important for Congress to pick a couple of things and just focus on them and complete them. Because one thing that happens when you do that is that you really illuminate what kind of people these people are
mm-hmm.
and what their conduct really, truly is. Because that's what needs to be shown. We're way past the point where anyone should think that the Bush administration operates in good faith about anything.
Yes. Now, there are a lot of people. I actually see more people, I think, in the media who tend to act like they're acting in good faith.
Right.
Than I do in the general population now, which I think is kind of bizarre, too.
Right. In fact, I just read a short editorial by Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times where he said, he was talking about the Scooter Libby case and the fact that there seems to be so much involvement on the part of the White House. And what he says is, it's time for the administration to come clean and give us a candid statement about what they did. And I thought, well, that's adorable that Nicholas Kristof would think that they would ever do that. You
it's
know?
Sort of sweet, isn't it?
It really is.
It's like, you know, you've never told the truth before. Why didn't you try this once and see how you like it?
Right, because that's just not going to happen.
Never.
Right.
Right. It's sort of cute. I mean, I do think it's kind of cute, but at the same time, it's also kind of scary that they could still be so naive.
Right, it is. It is, and I think that a lot of it has to do, I'm sorry to say, with kind of the old boys network. And this is something I don't talk about the old boys network in the book, but I do talk about the idea that in our society, it seems to be worse to actually suggest or even say that someone else is lying. It's worse to say it or make the accusation than it is to actually commit the lie.
Now, that's interesting. That's a very interesting insight.
Right, and it's a really tragic thing for our culture because we can't ever talk about, we can't ever get to the truth because no one feels comfortable saying, well, somebody is lying here.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, they are lying. The administration is lying all the time.
Well, they actually may be at the point where they can't tell when they're telling the truth.
Well, that's possible. That's possible. But when you look, for example, at what they said about the war, you know that they were trying to make the best case they could for the war. So it's a really good gauge of telling, of proving that they knew they were lying because they would just go right up to the edge of what would be an outright lie and not go any further because they wanted to be able to say, well, this is technically true. And that's what they said the defense was to the statement in the State of the Union where the president said the British have recently learned that Iraq was trying to get uranium from Niger. And then when they were called on it, they said, well, it was true. The British did say that. And so that tells you that they're trying to deceive.
Yes, well, it does. It's, you know, there's just a kindergartenish thing about the
right,
whole thing. Because that's a sign, kind of, I'm sure you did too. This is the sort of thing you got from your kids when they were that age.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. And but yet these are the highest elected officials we have in the United States.
Which shows you it doesn't necessarily indicate the level of accountability or maturity.
No. And it also seems to indicate that, and they have been able to get away with it, which is was a really big problem. But these kinds of deceptions are the kinds of things that people get put in jail around the country for every week. That's why the Enron officials were convicted, because here's just an example of a half-truth. Ken Lay told his employees when the company was going down the tubes, I bought $4 million of stock this month. And he's trying to tell them that things are going well. Well, he left out the part about the fact that he sold $24
million. Oh, well, that would be indicative.
Right, right. And that's something that people were entitled to know. Cheney did the same kind of thing. He went around and said, well, we know that Saddam Hussein has chemical weapons because his son-in-law told us. Well, the part he left out was really two parts. One was that the son-in-law had made that statement in 1995, and of course we were in 2003, but also the son-in-law had said that the chemical weapons were destroyed.
Yes.
So that was kind of a key point that the American people needed to have to evaluate the truth of the statement. And so it's just kind of really classic fraud that they used over and over and over again in this massively orchestrated way And I don't think we can just say, well, you know, what's done is done. That's it.
Yes, I mean, it isn't like he can come out of office and have his presidential library and go back to having a lovely house in Highland Park, Texas, and do everything else that he obviously wants to do because too many things have happened. Too much water under the bridge.
Right. Well, we have hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who've been killed because of this war, and not to mention our own soldiers, and we have 2 million Iraqis who are displaced, which I just learned was equivalent to, proportionally, to the population of California.
Oh, my heavens.
Vis-a-vis the United States.
That is so appalling.
Right.
Well, what do you think about the present sort of focus of the impeachment movement and the really very greatly growing number of people who are now determined that something needs to be done? You've spoken with David Swanson
mm-hmm.
and others on this. What do you think we're going to be going now?
Well, I think what the most critical thing is that, first of all, for people to say what they think, for individual citizens to make their opinions known, whether they're at a protest or at an impeachment forum or signing a petition or writing a letter to Congress, that has a value in and of itself because Thomas Jefferson said, one man, I'm sure you meant woman too, with courage is a majority. So that in and of itself has a value. But then when you get more and more people standing up and doing that, you start to get a movement growing. And we don't know what the outcome will be, obviously. But thus far you have this resolution introduced in Washington State. There's one in New Mexico. There's one in Vermont. There's cities and towns all across the country. There's some in the Midwest, so it is around the country at least. So I think if people feel that something should be done about the conduct of this president and certainly about this war, I think they should check out afterdyingstreet.org and look into what they can do as well.
Yeah. And where can our visitors get your book? And where can they hear you speak in person? Where can they find out about that? Is there a website?
There's a website for the book, which is www.7stories.com, stories.com, and that has a listing of events. It's not always up to date because 7 Stories is kind of small press, but we try to keep it up to date. And also, the book is at Barnes & Noble and independent bookstores, and it is on Amazon as well.
So they can just go get it.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for being with us today. I think this has been fascinating and very informative. And I know I'm going to go out and get your book right away.
Well, great. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye. And that's our show for today, Friday, January 23rd, 2007. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find ways to bring government into alignment with the way we know we should be treating each other. Not just personally, but in business and at every other point in our lives. Freedom in doing the right thing really does matter. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed, but went a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object. Evidence is a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.